Hello, everyone, and welcome to Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio. We are your hosts, Quinn Miles.
And Julian Chef-Prasad.
We are 1Ls here at Queen's Faculty of Law. Queen's Pro Bono Radio discusses interesting and off-center legal topics that aim to make legal discussions more accessible to you, the general public. We strive to stimulate interest and provide information while always being entertaining. Always.
We will entertain you.
This week's topic is on the current cannabis laws in Canada and how the provisions in the Cannabis Act inhibit investment in the industry and the difficulties they place on legal retailers.
So before we start the show, we would like to say that the views expressed on the show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, the host, or the Queen's University Faculty of Law. This podcast does not contain any legal advice. PBSC is a student organization. This podcast was prepared with the assistance of PBSC Queen's Law student volunteers. PBSC student volunteers like us are not lawyers when we're not authorized to provide you with any legal advice. The podcast contains a general discussion of certain legal related issues only. So if you require specific legal advice, get off this podcast and speak to a lawyer.
Good advice.
Now let's begin. On October 17th, 2018, the Government of Canada legalized the recreational possession and use of cannabis under the Cannabis Act. Under Section 7 of the Act, some of its stated purposes are to A, protect the health of young persons by restricting their access to cannabis, B, to provide for the licit production of cannabis to reduce illicit activities in relation to cannabis, and C, to deter illicit activities in relation to cannabis through appropriate sanctions and enforcement measures.
Yes, and these are commendable goals. They aim to safeguard the youth and to curb criminal activities, but imagine this. Extremely stringent licensing requirements, THC limits, and constraints on advertising and labeling. It's like the legal vendors are getting tied up in red tape while the illegal folks are out there running wild with no rules.
Yeah, tell me about it.
Yeah, the underground cannabis world has no regulations, lower costs, sky-high THC volumes, bulk sales, and the ability to create lasting, trustworthy connections with their customers.
Yeah, so how can the legal cannabis market really compete with that at this stage in the game?
Not sure.
So, now, we're certainly not advocating for zero restrictions in legal cannabis production. The restrictions allow consumers to know exactly what they're putting into their bodies. However, what we're really doing is, I think we're really questioning whether the extent of the restrictions really help achieve the goals of the Cannabis Act, and what changes could be made to the Act to facilitate the goals. So I think we're going to rewind a little bit. Parliament rolled out this Act in 2018, thinking it was all foolproof, but hey, even the best laid out plans have a few hiccups. So within the Act, they set up a necessary review of the legislation to be undergone by an independent panel after 3 years of the Act being in effect. The pandemic delayed this, but from 2022 to 2023, all these independent experts from varying fields sat down with cannabis industry big shots. They had all these roundtable talks, they questioned industry reps one-on-one, and they really tried to figure out where the plan went a little off the rails and how they could potentially solve these issues.
Right, and let's fast forward till now. There's a full-blown advice package in the works from that expert panel, and that's set to hit Parliament in 2024. And actually, by the time this podcast airs, it might have been released, so keep your eye out for that. But today on our podcast, through interviews with cannabis industry legal gurus, we hope to illustrate what some of these issues that have been presented to the cannabis industry are. We are going to dig into the hurdles, the mess, and what has been brewing on the horizon. Stick around for the juicy details. It's going to be a wild ride.
Absolutely crazy.
Insane. And at the end, we're going to ponder and predict what types of changes could be coming to the Cannabis Act. And with that, let's get to our first interview. So joining us now is Louis Reddick. Mr. Reddick, thank you so much for joining us today on Pro Bono Radio. So Mr. Reddick is a partner at Gowling WLG at their Ottawa office. There, he heads the food and beverage group and co-leads the cannabis group. He mainly practices within regulatory and commercial law with specific focus on commercializing regulated products. Some of his areas of expertise include regulatory licensing, product distribution, product classification, manufacturing, advertising, packaging, and labeling. He often works with clients to develop marketing strategies as well as packaging and advertising designs that are both consumer-friendly and compliant with the law.
Mr. Reddick, aside from that brief introduction, is there anything else you'd like our audience to be aware of regarding your practice in the cannabis field?
No, I think you covered it.
We nailed it. Great. Okay. So with that, we can get into the meat of the issue. And let's refresh the audience on some of the background info to give context for some of the questions we're going to be asking Mr. Reddick today. So The Cannabis Act places a lot of restrictions on how cannabis is advertised. The reason being, one of the main goals of the act is to prevent young people from using cannabis. And it's also remember to keep in mind that another one of the act's main goals is to combat the black market and therefore reduce the weight of cannabis convictions on the criminal justice system. Now, today, part of what we're focusing on is how the Cannabis Act prohibits dispensaries and growers from engaging in what the act describes as lifestyle branding. This includes and prohibits advertising in sports or cultural events, advertising through testimonials, or using other similar marketing techniques that have the effect of making smoking cannabis seem desirable. And to get into the specifics of these restrictions, we'll go to Julian.
Thanks, Quinn. Before we get to the questions we have for you today, let's take a second to unpack exactly what's in Section 17, Subsection 1 of the Cannabis Act. It specifically prohibits the communication of information about price or distribution, any advertising in a manner where there are reasonable grounds to believe it could be appealing to young persons, advertising by means of any testimonial or endorsement, advertising with the depiction of a person, character, or animal, or by presenting cannabis products or any brand elements in a manner that associates it or the brand element with a way of life that suggests any glamour, recreation, excitement, vitality, or risk. To contrast, Section 17, Subsection 2 outlines that cannabis suppliers may promote cannabis in communication that is age-restricted, where young persons are not permitted by law in a prescribed place and manner. So what does this mean in practice, Quinn?
Well, in practice, Julian, what this has meant is that cannabis-related businesses are very hesitant to advertise any of their products outside a dispensary, and they often use nearly indistinguishable packaging. And even the dispensaries themselves don't advertise what they sell outside of their own store. Usually, customers know what they're buying because of the brand associated with the product being sold. For instance, if people purchase a chocolate bar, they'll typically refer to the brand. People won't just say, "I bought a chocolate bar." They'll say, "I bought a Mars bar," or Three Musketeers, or something like that. With this way of doing business in the cannabis field, where's the space for cannabis consumers to know what they're buying and from who? Now, with this tidbit of food for thought, let's get into the questions we have for Mr. Reddick today.
So our first question for today is, how does advertising help growers and dispensaries with attracting more customers? Would loosening the restrictions on how dispensaries and growers build their brand necessarily enable them to build a stronger brand that could take business away from the black market? If so, how? And if not, why?
Thank you. So, first of all, one of the key aspects of advertising is it's a manner in which companies communicate with their customers or potential customers. So, when there's restrictions on advertising, those restrictions would inherently create restrictions on a company's ability to communicate with their customers or potential customers. Now, there's always, in Canadian law, there's going to always be restrictions with respect to advertising, right? It can't be a free for all because there's always a concern that without limitations, you're going to put Canadians at risk, whether it be financial harm, health harm. So a basic example, there isn't a single product you're allowed to provide false or misleading advertising on. Now, obviously, if you're allowed to falsely or mislead false or provide false advertising or mislead consumers, it could grow sales,
Oh,
but
yeah.
it's also inappropriate, right? So the fact there's a limitation isn't so much the fact that there's a limitation isn't the problem. It's how the limitations are structured, communicated within the legislation, and the basis of those limitations. So first of all, when the regulator came out with the Cannabis Act and cannabis regulations, you hit the nail on the head. The two competing goals are how do you get products out of the black market, and at the same time, how do you prevent children from accessing? Both important things, right? And sometimes, or in many ways, those things are mutually exclusive, right? But also, in some ways, it could, by solving one problem, you're creating another, right? So, for example, there's significant restrictions on advertising to Canadians cannabis. And the reason for that is to keep it out of children's hands. right? Now, the black market is not subject to those restrictions. In essence, if regulators and enforcement agencies are not going to close down the black market through enforcement, and they're trying to eliminate the black market by attracting business to the legal market, right? Then effectively you have two different markets playing by two different rules. One doesn't have rules, right? And one does. Exactly. So the challenge with that is, well, the intention is noble. Well, obviously most Canadians don't want young children to access anything that could harm them. You know, the real question is, are we accomplishing that? Are kids getting less access to cannabis because of these advertising restrictions? If we can't pull business away from the black market, and the black market doesn't have restrictions, are children accessing or young persons accessing cannabis through the black market when they can't get it through the legal market, right? So these are important questions. I'm not the regulator, so it's something I'll leave with the regulator to struggle with and deliberate. But I think that the regulator probably should lend its mind to the notion of whether it struck that right balance, right? Whether it truly struck that right balance, because it really is a balancing act. There's no, you know, the eliminating cannabis isn't really an answer, because we know what that looked like, right? So cannabis is here, whether legal or not. Now, how do we strike the right balance to ensure you could protect the health and safety of young persons, but at the same time, and in doing so, I think keeping it out of the black market is part of that journey, right? There's also other considerations. You know, if young persons are going to access cannabis, which I understand and appreciate and agree that the goal should be that they don't access cannabis, but if they're going to access cannabis, is it better that they access cannabis that is from the legal market, which is subject to, you know, quality assurance controls, strict regulations about pesticide use and other harmful substances in addition to the cannabis? Or is it better that they access cannabis that started off in the black market, which would not be subject to any such regulatory framework on the quality of the product and therefore has a higher risk of including harmful substances that would also be harmful to those that consume it? So that's an important thing. And then the other piece I'd probably want to throw in there is, even if we accept at a high level that the restrictions on advertising should hold strong, the language used in the legislation has put somewhat of a freeze on the ability for companies to advertise, because they're vague, non-specific, and, you know, really, you could argue anything is in or not in some of these buckets, right? So the one that you read was, which I love, is by presenting cannabis products or any brand elements in a manner that associates it or the brand element with a way of life. Like, how is something not like, right? How do you pin that down? That suggests glamour. So glamour is something very much in the eye of the beholder, right? And recreation. What isn't recreation? What is recreation? Excitement. If I'm excited about cannabis, everything is excitement. Vitality or risk. So these are words that are kind of like, provide the regulator an ability to say everything is in it or maybe not in it. And one of the things that stands out in the cannabis space, which is a question that we raised when they proposed the Cannabis Act in the first place, or before the launch of the Cannabis Act, is, will Health Canada come out with a guidance document that at least provides its interpretation of the application of these provisions? Now, when you look at other product categories, if you look at the advertisement of food, the Canadian Food Inspection Agency has tons of policies online about its position. We might debate, we might disagree, I might think they're wrong, we might challenge them in court, but we know their position. We know if we do X, they will not bother us, but if we do Y, they're going to bother us, right? Same thing with drugs. But the cannabis space is fairly unique, where Health Canada isn't providing guidance on what its interpretation of the legislation is, which leaves companies in a very, very strange position.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, thank you for your insight. I think you brought up a lot of very interesting points, not even necessarily about liberalizing the restrictions only, but also about nuancing them, providing more information on what some of these things mean to at least better guide growers and dispensaries overall. I think, as you mentioned, you know, with foods and drugs and the regulations of those things, there's a lot more guidance. I think it could be partially because cannabis is such a young industry. It was only legalized a few years ago, recreationally. I think that was a very, very nascent point you could bring in. And then also the concept of, you know, quality control and the fact that, you know, although we are trying to limit the access of young people to cannabis, it's a lot better if they have access to a safe source at the very least.
Right.
Very good points.
Right. Yeah, like the point being, if a child consumes legally bought cannabis, you know exactly what they've just put into their bodies. Meanwhile, if they're consuming things taken off the black market, there might be a little bit more cause for concern for the parents.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, so again, thank you for your insight on that question. And
so this leads us
to Julian.
This leads us to our second and final question we have for you today. One might say there are pros and cons of loosening the restrictions on advertising faced by cannabis-related businesses. It could be said that loosening advertising restrictions currently in place might help players in the legal cannabis industry build stronger brands that instill more confidence in their ability to invest in better products that can compete with the black market. However, loosening advertising restrictions might also expose and entice underage Canadians to use cannabis more than with the present restrictions. Do you believe the benefits of loosening advertising restrictions outweigh the risks, perhaps?
I would lean towards yes. I would suggest that, you know, I don't know if loosening is necessarily the right word, but I would suggest, you know, at a very, very minimum, for the regulator to be much clearer on what it accepts as acceptable advertising, to even get a better understanding of what companies can do without concern of oversight versus what they can't when you look at the words in the legislation today. But I do believe that loosening advertising generally in the cannabis space would outweigh the detractors. For one thing, again, it's about striking that balance. There isn't a world where young persons aren't going to get access to cannabis. Like that's just not realistic. It might be a goal, a very ambitious goal, but that's not realistic. And so by having these two markets play by different rules and frankly giving the very group of people that the regulator doesn't want to have access to cannabis just through the black market, you know, I think you would have to assume that young persons today don't have access to cannabis and aren't consuming cannabis to get to the point where not loosening it would be the better outcome or the better approach, right? But if you assume young persons currently have access to cannabis, regardless of the legislation, right, then what you're really doing is allowing the black market to continue to grow and prosper, putting young persons at higher risk because there is more cannabis out in the market that is uncontrolled. We don't know what's in it. We don't know what the dosing is. And in many ways, not in many ways, plays by different rules. Like we've seen non-compliant cannabis with characters and cartoon-like characters and associated with brands that are, you know, breakfast, everything from breakfast cereals to chocolate bars that are currently on the market, obviously illegally, right, with trademark violations. But again, it's the black market. They don't play by the same rules. So all these are things that are enticing that you would even with loosening the rules in advertising, you would never get to that point, right? It could be loosened in a controlled sense. So that's where my view is.
Right. I think a point to be made towards loosening advertising is like you might be able to see a lot of parallels between the cannabis industry and the alcohol industry. And it might just be so that, like, right now, smoking is a lot more stigmatized than drinking still is. So as most people say, like, smoking weed and stuff is not a good look for most people. Meanwhile, drinking is more part of our culture. So there's still a point that alcohol, we don't want young people consuming alcohol, but yet we don't have the same restrictions. And we accept right. that, like, young people are going to access alcohol either way. So it's interesting to think that one day we might be able to reach this point where alcohol and cannabis might be on the same sort of sociological level, where it's not nearly as stigmatized, so we don't mind the advertising as much, while accepting that young people are going to get this either way. So we might as well help the business by allowing them to market themselves.
Yeah, and it's also important to remember that unlike alcohol, well, maybe more like alcohol, but certainly unlike cigarettes or tobacco, it's a lot easier for people to self-create cannabis. And that is also another thing to consider, right? It's, again, it goes to the point of it's there. It's accessible. We're kind of fooling ourselves if we don't think it is. Of course, you know, as a parent myself, I want very strong restrictions. I don't want my kids to have access to it. But you know, if they did get access to it, I'd prefer it be the safer stuff than not know what's in it.
Right.
Absolutely. And I'd just like to circle back to our first question for the audience and a discussion we were having earlier prior to the interview about the nuance, just introducing more nuance into the Cannabis Act and the restrictions. We had a talk earlier about the fact that cannabis itself, what is cannabis? And the distinction between THC and CBD cannabis and the different uses and purposes for those two things. So what's your take on sort of the nuance of even what is cannabis and how the Cannabis Act might be, you know, could potentially be, you know, too vague on even nuancing what cannabis is and how it's used?
I'm glad you asked that question. So in Canada, because it's different in other markets, in Canada, CBD, regardless of the source of CBD, regardless of whether it's made in a lab or any form of CBD, is deemed cannabis, right? And it's not that the law is vague. The law is actually very clear on this. So everything that could potentially come from a cannabis plant is cannabis, whether it actually came from the cannabis plant or not, right? And the problem with this is that consumers use CBD for different purposes than THC, right? So THC is a psychoactive. It makes you feel high. CBD is not a psychoactive, right? People typically take CBD for dietary supplement or dietary supplement-like uses, right? For health benefits, right? Joint pain. I'm not a doctor. I'm not giving dosing here. I'm just saying that the intent, right? The intent of the consumer is for those purposes. So we're kind of in a weird situation where CBD is regulated exactly like cannabis, like THC. You can't market it or advertise it. It doesn't have any claims on it. Now, in theory, you could get it approved as a prescription drug, but that's just not realistic for a variety of reasons in most cases. So it ultimately ends up in this cannabis category. So you have consumers who otherwise might not even be, or often aren't, regular cannabis consumers. They're not THC users. They've never used it for psychoactive purposes. But they want to take it because they read somewhere it helps with epilepsy or joint pain or any other ailment that users of CBD, that CBD might be used for, whether it works or whether it doesn't. It's not a judgment here. So, you know, as you can imagine, we're kind of in a structure where a consumer goes into a cannabis dispensary and they ask a bud tender, you know, for advice on CBD usage for epilepsy, right? Or CBD usage for some other ailment. And there's, I'm not sure that this is for the benefit of consumers, right? I'm not sure that it lines up with what the goals of the regulator are supposed to be. It's a little bit like buying Advil at a gas station, right? There's an oddity to it. And so I think that Health Canada, you know, should consider moving faster. I know they've talked about looking at this, of kind of either creating a hybrid category or for CBD or moving it into more of an NHP category. But CBD should be accessible at places where consumers would normally buy products that are in that kind of dietary supplement to OTC sort of space. There should be proper communication on the packaging, what's too much, what's too little, so that consumers can be informed. Because right now, there is literally no other reason to consume CBD because it doesn't give you a psychoactive high. It's not recreationally used. So it's odd, and it's something that should be looked at, carve it out in its own space.
Right.
I guess we'll just close it out now. So Mr. Reddick, thank you so much for taking the time to join in our discussion of the current state of cannabis law in Canada. It's been delightful to listen and hear your point of view regarding these issues. And once again, I'd just like to thank you for joining us today on Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio. Is there anything you'd like to say to our audience before we close out the interview?
No, thank you very much.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. So my main takeaway from that discussion was that, one, it's a reality that some kids are still going to smoke weed, even though they're not allowed to, and it's not advertised. And, you know, it's not like there's many teenagers that have no idea what weed is because of its lack of advertising. So we need to take that into consideration when it comes to the regulations on advertising. Second, we need some clarification on the language in the act. So, like, what is lifestyle branding or what's glamour? And three, what exactly is cannabis and should CBD really be included in that?
Yeah, I agree. At a bare minimum, I think Lewis really emphasized a need for the legislature to be a lot more explicit and intentional in some of the language that's used in the Cannabis Act. They don't really need to loosen the Cannabis Act per se, like we might have thought before interviews.
Yeah.
Glamour and lifestyle branding are pretty subjective concepts, and this has caused cannabis companies, I think, to be afraid, for lack of a better word, to do any sort of advertising, because with the language, really anything could be glamorous or lifestyle branding. So with that, legal cannabis industries cannot really communicate with their customers, while the black market has free reins to do whatever, even lie about what's in their product.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the language putting a freeze on advertising, I think it's, you know, specifically, like, who advertises to make something look bad?
Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah, you want to advertise something in a positive light. So if you do that with cannabis, it seems pretty likely that that'll attract the attention of the regulator, because they could just deem anything to be shown in a positive light to be glamorous. So really what I took from Mr. Reddick is that at least before we quote-unquote loosen restrictions, we at least be given more guidance on what the language and the legislation means if we want to better achieve the goals of the legislation. Okay, yeah, anyway, so again, thanks to Lewis Reddick from Gowling WLG in Ottawa. And now let's get on to our second interview.
Joining us now on Pro Bono Radio is Matt Maurer. Mr. Maurer, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So Mr. Maurer is a partner at Torkin Mains LLP in Toronto. There, he's a partner and chair of both the firm's cannabis law and franchise law groups. In his role, Matt applies his practical business and regulatory advice to counsel a wide range of cannabis industry stakeholders, such as licensed producers, people applying to be producers, startups, and foreign businesses looking to enter the Canadian market. His expertise in this field have made him a sought-after lawyer. He has acted on behalf of a number of American and international celebrities seeking advice on their relationships with the Canadian cannabis companies.
Mr. Maurer, aside from that brief introduction, is there anything else you would like to let the audience know about your practice in the cannabis field?
I don't think so. I think it's a pretty broad practice range. I started this before legalization occurred, thinking that this was going to be a heavily regulated industry and a brand new one. And therefore, it was kind of open season, if you will, for lawyers to get into this type of work. So it's, you know, over the last 6 years, it's been pretty broad. And as you adequately captured there, which is fun. It's a lot, you deal with a lot of different people and a lot of definitely interesting people for sure.
Awesome. Well, to get into the issues of today, we'll refresh our audience that the cannabis demands stringent background checks and licensing requirements on many who decide to participate in the cannabis industry. And remember, the act strives to prevent young people from using cannabis while also combating the black market. So they likely do not want to be licensing people who are likely to allow cannabis to fall into the hands of young people or black market players.
For this part of the podcast, we're exploring the idea of how stringent licensing and background check requirements can make it a lot harder for cannabis businesses to attract enough investment to thrive, and whether these barriers actually assist the government in meeting the purposes of the act.
Now, back in 2017, before legalization, Castles, Brock, and Graydon released an insight that revealed a problem cannabis industry players might face upon legalization. And ultimately, they were right. Banks didn't really want to lend the money for two main reasons. The first one isn't really a legal reason, but more so a reputational one. Banks claim to experience damage from associating with the cannabis industry. However, this hesitation on behalf of banks wasn't purely reputational. There were also legal reasons banks didn't want to invest in the cannabis industry. And what are those, Julian?
For instance, the licensing restrictions placed on cannabis industry players by the Cannabis Act and Health Canada are quite tough and invasive. The Health Canada security clearance needed to obtain a license that authorizes cannabis activities involves a domestic criminal record check, a foreign criminal record check if applicable, and a law enforcement record check that reveals all publicly available intelligence information about the applicant. This intelligence information even includes interactions with police that didn't even lead to a charge or conviction.
Now, these licenses to operate are not transferable and can be confiscated if one of the many rules that limit how cannabis is sold gets broken. Now, this means that a bank will always keep in mind that one wrong move made by their borrowers can get their source of repayment eliminated. Furthermore, it's hard to realize a cannabis business as collateral because all directors and officers in the business have to pass the invasive background check that we discussed to even get the authorization needed to be an active part of the cannabis business. Now, it's clear that cannabis businesses are still frustrated with the bank's continuous hesitancy to do business with them. On February 10th, 2023, a class action lawsuit was launched on behalf of Gabriel Bélanger by Group SGF against Desjardins, National Bank, Royal Bank, Bank of Montreal, TD Bank, and CIBC. The lawsuit alleges that these banks have financially discriminated against legal actors in the cannabis industry, and mainly these allegations of discrimination include the denial of bank accounts, sudden closures of bank accounts, and denial of access to various financial tools like mortgages and lines of credit.
If the cannabis industry players can't borrow, they usually look for investors. However, even this comes with its own challenges. McCarthy Tetro released an insight that suggested security clearances might also impact the ability for cannabis market players to attract large investors. When a person decides to acquire a significant ownership interest or has any influence on a company's management and operations in a cannabis license holding business, they're to get federal security clearance or provide significant personal disclosure, like what we discussed. However, the level of personal disclosure needed by Health Canada is unfavorable to investors and often considered untenable. Finally, Section 65 of the Cannabis Act outlines that a minister may revoke a license or permit if the holder is an individual who has, since its issuance, ceased to be ordinarily resident of Canada. As a consequence, it seems like foreign investment is also problematized. Now, we'll get into the question. Mr. Maurer, how specifically might these barriers to attracting investment posed by licensing lead to higher prices and little comparative advantage over the black market for legal cannabis businesses? Are there more barriers we might have glossed over? To contrast, how might inviting more means of sourcing capital in the cannabis industry foster the ability for dispensaries and growers to work together and offer lower prices and higher quality products, potentially better competing with the black market?
Well, there's a lot to unpack there in the historical you guys went through, and in that question, it's one of the interesting things about the industry is that it is so interesting, and there's so many nuances to it and different things. So, you know, kind of going back up to some things you talked about before, these license and background checks, you know, are they helpful or not? I understand why the government wants to do them. I do think they're helpful, and I don't think there's anything wrong with doing them. It's kind of just goes to this almost myth that, you know, because cannabis was illegal and now has become legal, it's just going to be rife with criminals, more so than any other industry. You know, they don't They don't ask for background checks, to my knowledge, although I haven't looked into this, if you want to be a tow truck driver or own a tow truck company. But, you know, we've seen in the news all these corruption scandals and everything else. So, you know, the background checks help. And part of me understands why they did it. But part of me always thinks it's funny how bent out of shape the government can get over certain things in this industry when really it's no worse, if not better, than other industries. And, you know, to that, kind of goes back to that comment you made about the banks and how originally it was reputational and there were some legal concerns. You know, I would say now it's pretty much all reputational. It was interesting back when, just before cannabis was legalized, it was like law firms, banks, and accounting firms, which are all very conservative. You know, they didn't want to have anything to do with this. And a few of them started, you know, allowing, they saw sort of the opportunity, right? It's a legal industry. Why wouldn't we get into this? And then, so for example, in accounting, you saw firms like MNP come in right away and, you know, really capture a large share of the cannabis industry for accountants. And then, you know, BDO comes along after them and then maybe EY, but they were slower and because those bigger, more institutional type companies, and this was the same with insurance as well, and banks, they didn't want to be associated. There was this kind of lingering stigma. And law firms were very much the same. A lot of the law firms wanted nothing to do with this. When I decided to start practicing cannabis law, some people in my firm were very supportive. Others thought this was crazy and, you know, make us look bad. And what do we tell our other clients? But then as time goes on and, you know, there's legal work to do, whether it's legal work or accounting work or banking, and there's a lot of money to be made because it's a brand new industry. Suddenly, a lot of those more institutional and conservative, you know, entities are happy to do that work and happy to get in on that. So that narrative kind of shifted. But with banks, it's still the same. You know, for a long time, Alterna, which is a credit union based out of Ottawa, they're really still the only banking entity, you know, bank or credit union that will service these cannabis companies. Some of the big banks will, but they charge astronomical fees because of what they will call the risk, which is actually insane if you think about it, because what other industry are you lending to where everyone has to have a background check and the government's monitoring everything they could possibly do? You know, I don't see how that's so risky. And I forgot about the class action lawsuit. I'm curious to see when I read the lawsuit, I don't even think I saw the statement of claim. I might have just seen an article about it. But the first thing I thought is, well, although I might not agree with it, like who is someone else to tell a bank which customers and they can and can't take, you know? If it's not, as I understand it, it is reputational and it is risk-based. It's not anything else. So if, you know, the bank feels this business, this cannabis retail store, this licensed producer is too risky to lend to, because look what's happening in the industry. They're all shuttering their doors and there's contraction. Well, who's a judge to come along and say, you know what? No, you actually do have to lend them money. That's not fair, right? It just seems nuts. You know, if it was for a different reason, perhaps, but, you know, good for them for being skeptical and cautious, you know, because there is a lot of people, there are a lot of people in this industry who, you know, not that they're bad actors, they're just not good business people. They're just not good with their money. We've seen that with, you know, really big companies, you know, Canopy's getting the, you know, proverbial crack kicked out of them right now. You know, everyone saw the boom and then the bust, and it's just kind of one thing after another for them. So it's, you know, I don't blame banks for being a little bit hesitant on who they'd lend to. Other things like not giving bank accounts and stuff, that I just can't wrap my head around it. So, and the other thought I had, and I'm happy to discuss any of these things in more detail, is, you know, that question about foreign investment. The problem now in the industry is no one wants to invest, right? Because you saw this. I think everyone got way too excited when things were good. There was a time, I remember when I started, I think there was 24 licensed producers. There's got to be over 1,000 now, I think. And it was, you know, on a Friday, there would be an announcement from the government, not every Friday, like it was a special Friday, like you never knew. Is someone going to get, you know, their letter that basically said they were pre-clearance, like they're getting their pre-inspection done? Because if someone got that, it was almost a given that they would be getting a license within, you know, a matter of weeks or months. And as soon as someone got that, they could go to the market and raise an insane amount of money solely based on the license and pretty much nothing else. That's how rare they were. So, you know, you take that where everyone's throwing money hand over fist at these companies that are getting licensed. It's a new industry. You know, people made a lot of money selling weed when it's illegal. So certainly they're going to make a lot of money selling it when it's legal. That's, you know, some faulty logic there, but that's a different discussion. And then when, you know, people bought too many greenhouses, built too many warehouses, you know, we're going to go partner in Africa and countries that people had never heard of in Malta. And we're going to take over the world. And, you know, part of it I get because Canada was the first to legalize. And in theory, we would be able to sort of export that knowledge or those skills or even the product to other countries because we were the first ones. But, you know, so many companies rushed to get so big and extend their reach so quickly without fully understanding what the domestic market was going to be like, and without, I think, really appreciating that these other countries weren't coming online anytime soon, not the same way we were. And even if they did, I always thought, who's to say they're going to let you import anything? I kind of look back at it as sort of a trade sort of arrangement. In Canada, you can export and you can import for scientific or medical purposes. And it's done on basically a shipment by shipment. You need a permit for each time you're going to do a shipment. But, you know, I always thought, why would the Canadian government ever let, you know, Mexican companies or Asian companies or pick anywhere else where it's really hot and you can grow cannabis super cheap, South America? Why would they let companies from there import it into Canada and put all these LPs out of business that spent millions, tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars building these huge facilities, providing jobs? It's just never going to happen. Like, it would just destroy our industry if we let it in, you know, tax-free. So conversely, who's going to let us start importing into their country because we're the first and we're the best? You know, I always thought that was something that just seemed a little bit ambitious and, you know, turned out it was. And so anyway, all of this to say that we kind of had this high where you could make money, like you just sneeze and you're going to make money, to, you know, basically making it impossible to get dollars raised and invest and get investors. And now it's kind of settling into this area where supply and demand is starting to equal out, and it's becoming a quote unquote normal industry, you know, an established industry. It's still overregulated, I think, but it's a challenge because until there's another good business case to make for an investor, you know, no one wants to invest in another grower. No one wants to invest in another retail store. Yeah. And that's been going on for years because, I just remember, you know, it's, well, we're not a grower. We have new technology. And that was kind of the differentiating factor when investment money started to dry up. So,
oh, I see. Thanks a lot for your insight, Mr. Mauro. So just to sort of wrap that up for our audience. So essentially what you're saying is that cannabis, like any other nation industry, went through a huge boom and bust period. Like we saw when it became legal, we saw a lot of, you know, capital rushing in, and we saw a sort of oversaturation of the market, and now we're seeing a correction. And then amongst all of that, we have, you know, all of this regulation and all of these background checks, and which is sort of leads us to question, well, what is it that is making the cannabis market the legal cannabis market unable to compete with the illegal cannabis market? Would you say that it's, how much would you say these restrictions contribute to the legal cannabis market potentially not being as able to compete with the black market as it could be? Do you think?
It's huge. It's overregulation is what it is. And, you know, I understand why I'm not saying I agree with it, but I understand why it was heavily regulated to start. Yeah. And now, you know, now we're in our 5-year or 3-year review, or what was supposed to be a 5-year review, and that's delayed. But you know, it's just unnecessary, right? Like the goal is to protect children and public health. Like that to me is the primary objective, right? Like they say they never did this to create an industry and to create jobs and everything. No, we did it because the black market was, you know, unregulated product, you know, criminals selling it, children buying it. If we regulate it, it'll be okay. And that was the goal. And it's just, it's too much in terms of like, how do you compete when, and it's not just with the black market, you know, like look at the OCS, for example, right? In Ontario, they are the most profitable cannabis company in all of Canada. I can't remember what the profit there, but they're sitting on, I think it's like $275 million of profit.
Wow.
Well, in part, why is that? It's a little bit different from the background checks and stuff, but well, they can ship by Canada Post. They can ship by website. They don't have to have their own employees do delivery drivers like the stores do. Like when you compare what the OCS can do to what the stores can do, it's, you know, it's no wonder that they do so well, you know, making so much money. And then on top of that, they're the mandatory wholesaler. Everything has to go through them. Yeah. And so there's inefficiencies. Stores will complain. Stores and LPs complain about the purchasing, about the selling, about how long it takes to get paid from the OCS. You know, how they, you know, bungle the orders, bungle the software, just, you know, like any government meddling in a business is bungling things up. And then you put that all on everything else where you've got everyone and their dog trying to open a store and compete because, you know, cannabis is their passion and it's been like that for their life. And, you know, you've got, 30 stores on Princess Street as you walk down, right? Like, I don't know what it is out there in Kingston right now, but it's like, of course they're going to go out of business. And then you throw on the taxes and everything else. So, you know, the background checks and the security checks, I don't think they themselves are overly problematic. It used to be in an interesting way. It took forever to get them, and you couldn't get a license until your key people were all security cleared by the RCMP. And there was very little insight as to what that process was for a long time. And there was very little insight as to how long it was going to take. It could take 8 months or longer to get your security clearance so you can open and get a license and start producing cannabis. And, you know, cannabis moves, the industry moves very fast. And if, you know, you've got plans to do something and you're held up for 8 months because of a background check, like that's going to have an impact too, right? So.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I think what we're seeing here is we're seeing a lot of people trying to capture this opportunity. And then after we see a bunch of people trying to capture this opportunity, we're seeing a lot of regulation and a lot of hesitancy on banks. And what this essentially is doing is this is promoting a sort of unsustainable business model. And so we're seeing right now we're running into a correction. And so if we were to potentially revisit these regulations, we could potentially see a more healthy growth of the legal cannabis industry that might have a chance at fighting the black market. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's like a calamity of errors, and you know, like it's just the way they did the lottery in Ontario, the way they give out the store application, the licenses where you don't know necessarily who your competitors are or where they're located until they show up in the public notice phase of the application. Suddenly they appear on a map after you signed a lease, you know, and committed yourself and personally guaranteed it. And like I said, you know, the demand for product is there. How much, I don't know. But, you know, the OCS making hundreds of millions of dollars is all you need to know that people are buying it. Stores are making money, like, not all of them, but you know, there's profitable stores. Supply and demand on stores is a different question altogether. So, you know, it's, and then you've got the, you know, the black market still undercutting you on prices and all kinds of other things. So if you start rolling back a lot of these regulations, and not even a lot of them, but just, you know, some key ones to start, I think you can maintain that, protect the youth, protect public health, and really, you know, open this up so that this industry can actually compete. People can survive, people can get, you know, create jobs and business and all these things. And so, you know, one of the first ones would be things like, you know, marketing and promotion type things, you know, restrictions around how it can be delivered. It just seems like the background check, great, but not just on the, like, when I say restrictions, usually the first thing that comes to mind is prohibitions on things, you know, about how it has to be packaged, what it can say, what it can't say. But even the regulation and the restrictions on, in Ontario, for example, of having to deal with a government wholesaler, and just, you know, I personally just watch this from top down, and at every stage, there's an inefficiency someone's kind of jamming in, or an additional requirement or an additional tax. And, it, you know, it's so much of it that it's a surprise that anyone's making a go of it.
A lot of red tape involved.
A lot of red tape.
Like, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And a lot of missed opportunity to actually fight the black market and really get down to the purposes of the Cannabis Act.
Yeah. And it's, again, I guess politically it was so controversial to legalize it that I can understand from a political point of view, wanting to be very tough on it, wanting to be very, you know, rigid. But, you know, here we are almost 6 years later. Like, I think we can learn some lessons, and people thought that society would collapse when we legalized it to begin with.
I remember.
Nothing really changed. Like, the sidewalk smells now and then, right? Like, you get a little whiff, that you might not get, but like,
Dunk.
I think other things too, which kind of, you know, on a little bit of a tangent, but like, let me buy a cannabis beverage at a restaurant or at a bar or at a concert, or, you know, you're also taking away key points of sale for what reason? Like, why can I go into, you know, if I check into a hotel and I want room service, why can I order whatever alcohol I want, but you can't bring me up a, you know, THC seltzer or something? Like, there's just no reason at all for that.
That reminds me of earlier in the podcast, we talked to Mr. Reddick from Gowling, and we talked about alcohol briefly. When we know as a society, we can accept that there are some legal substances that are damaging to health, but we tolerate them. And I think this just goes back to reputation and the stigmas in society. So the good news is, though, this legislation does get a review, and you did mention it is late.
It's so late. I couldn't remember if it's 3 years or 5 years, because
I think it's 5 years.
Yeah. I'm like, is it three and we're so far over? Is it five?
Oh, no. Yeah, they were supposed to do it. They were supposed to do it after 3 years, and then COVID and everything happened. So I think that's been part of the delay. But I think, yeah, the results of that review are supposed to come out in March, I think. So maybe we'll have some idea of what's to come.
If it's supposed to, maybe we will. You know, maybe it'll come out in September. I'll be very curious to see. You know, it's in. I was talking to someone else just this week about, or last week, about Loblaws and this lifting the cap in Ontario from 75 stores to 150 stores. And I thought, who asked for that? Like, you're like, that doesn't help. That doesn't really help anyone. Like, that's the change they're making. How about, you know, take down the OPEG windows so they don't get robbed, like, when people come into the store, instead of, you know, doing this. And then, of course, Loblaws wants to get it. Well, now, of course, it makes sense that they raise the cap. Someone's come in. They came in and lobbied them, right? So anyway, I digress. All
right.
Anything? Yeah. Any other pressing questions? I can't think of any.
That was a pretty good.
All right. That was awesome. So, Mr. Maurer, thank you so much for taking the time to join us in the discussion of the current state of cannabis law in Canada. It has been delightful to listen and hear your point of view regarding these issues. And once again, I'd like to thank you for joining us today on Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio. Is there anything you'd like to say to our audience before we close out the interview?
This is where I'm supposed to yell, go Gales, or something like that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Any last minute plugs? But yeah, go Gales.
No. enjoy the time you still got in school. It'll be the last few amazing years of your life. Although the practice of law is also wonderful, but enjoy it, unrelated to cannabis, enjoy every minute of it, because it's a great time.
Well, thank you. Our listeners will be happy to hear that as well. And again, thank you.
I think that conversation really brought a bunch of interesting developments in the cannabis area, a few of which really stood out to me. Mm-hmm. I think the first thing that really stood out was this unjustified poor stigma that the cannabis industry is rife with criminality. I think that stigma is behind a lot of the really restrictive legislation we see placed around the use and the sale of weed. But there's a bunch of other industries with more crime than the cannabis industry, like the tow truck industry, for instance. There's a lot of crime going on there.
They're crazy.
But at the same time, you know, you don't really see those restrictions in that industry. And think of all the crimes people commit when they're drunk. Like people, crimes people commit under the influence of alcohol.
Lots of crimes.
Exactly. Second, I think that we really learned where the focus of our call to action needs to go. The questions we asked on the licensing and background checks, placing a barrier to more investment in the cannabis industry, might not have been the right focus. There are all these pressing issues we discussed with Mr. Maurer, like the unfair advantages the OCS have that retailers and growers do not have, like the ability to use Canada Post. Furthermore, you know, we need to stop contributing to this OCS dropshipping hustle they have going on. Why should all growers and retailers need to go through the OCS just so they can get their share of profits, basically doing nothing but raising prices for consumers? Also, look at the advertising and packaging restrictions we discussed with Lewis Reddick.
Yeah, right. Sorry, I'm just like thinking about your first takeaway about that discussion about like how cannabis is associated with crime. And, you know, maybe there needs to be a little bit more public education on cannabis, but I think that'll come with time. And, you know, a big reason why it's very much associated with criminality is because a few years ago, it actually was a crime. So just perhaps once time has passed, the association with criminality might fade. And with that, maybe the restrictions will lighten a bit.
So. Yeah, I mean, I agree. Like getting over the reefer madness phase, changing the mind of society takes time.
Yeah, okay, so now with our podcast coming towards its end, we want to again give a major thank you to our two expert interviewees today, Lewis Reddick and Matt Maurer. Their insights have definitely been enlightening on the issues created by the Cannabis Act.
Yeah, so I think now we'll discuss what we think about some of these potential changes to the cannabis law, what they might be. Quinn, do you want to go first here?
Oh, sure. First, I think we can both agree, like stemming from our conversation with Mr. Reddick, is that we need more guidance on what the language in the Cannabis Act means. So if the Canadian government can be more specific on what they can advertise in the area, or if Health Canada could even provide their interpretations about what that language means, like what's glamour, businesses will be able to know what liberties they can take with advertising.
Yeah, like when Lewis Reddick brought up the vague prohibitions on lifestyle branding, glamour, and recreation, like you mentioned. If you're advertising something, you want the ad to attract people to your product. That's the whole point of an ad.
Right.
So what's the legislature really trying to say with this? I feel like there needs to be a lot more specificity. So that takes us to our first call to action, which is just for more guidance on the language.
Right.
So some of the language in the act.
Okay, and now another thing highlighted by Mr. Reddick was that as it stands, CBD is also considered cannabis, so it's under the same regulations. But CBD is not psychoactive. People don't buy it to get high. They buy it for dietary or health reasons. So with that, we have people who work, we have people who work at cannabis dispensaries advising people on what they should buy to best address their health concerns, which is a pretty odd situation. I'm personally of the mind that health and dietary professionals should maybe advise on those types of questions.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I don't know if that is controversial. So with that, maybe to not produce a little like absurd effects, we can narrow the scope of what should be considered cannabis for the purposes of this act. And again, to repeat, the goals are to protect the youth and to curb the black market. So we recommend that cannabis be narrowed to the psychoactive ingredients of a cannabis plant. So then maybe CBD can be distributed by a proper person, maybe like a pharmacist.
Yeah. Mr. Maurer also brought up a very interesting point that OCS is hogging Canada Post. And the Alcohol and Gaming Commissions of Ontario isn't letting any of the other retailers use it. The AGCO delivery guidelines tell retailers that delivery can't be done by any third parties.
Yeah, and meanwhile, we have the black market selling online through Canada Post. So who's really advantaged here? I think it might be a good idea to take away the obvious win for the black market by revisiting some of the AGCO bylaws that dictate who can deliver cannabis.
Yeah. Right now, the state of how retailers and growers communicate gives these hammer and sickle vibes. The AGCO states under the general section that all cannabis retailers must buy from the Ontario Cannabis Retail Store through this supply contract. and all growers must sell to the Ontario Cannabis Retail Store. So essentially, what we have here is we have the OCS taking a giant markup for being the middleman, so retailers and growers make less.
Yeah, so why does the AGO mandate, the AGCO, why does it mandate that OCS to be this unwelcome middleman? If we want Canadians to buy cannabis at a price that's affordable and competitive with the black market, why don't we just get rid of this obvious contributor to increased prices? We can keep the same quality guidelines on retailers and growers without the OCS, can't we?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I think so. So we have pondered that loosening restrictions on advertising might be an idea. But, you know, the obvious counterpoint to this is that this would have the effect of further enticing youths to smoke cannabis. As you mentioned earlier, Julian, companies generally don't advertise their products in a negative light.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah, so if cannabis is being advertised, it's likely in a way that encourages people to smoke. So allowing more advertising might negatively affect the purposes of the act on both fronts. It'll cause more youth to smoke cannabis, and it may drive more business to the black market because it's easier for youths to access it that way. So I am going to put forward a controversial idea, which maybe is lowering the smoking age.
Yeah, I figured you were going to say that.
Yeah, I'm crazy.
Right? I mean, yeah, like we've discussed in this podcast, it's just reality that some kids are going to smoke weed, whether they're allowed to or not, regardless of if they haven't or have seen cannabis advertised. They can access it through the black market, so it's not impossible for them to get it through the legal market. They have fake IDs, or they can even ask a favor from somebody.
Right. Yeah, so I'm thinking if we allow youth, like teenagers, I'm not thinking like little kids here.
Of course not.
If we allow them to access legal dispensaries, maybe we can achieve both goals of the act, in that we can protect the youth who choose to smoke cannabis by providing them with a safe supply. And in that fashion, we might, we might also drive those particular youths away from the black market. And I'm not a health expert. I have no suggestions as to what an appropriate weed smoking age is. But it is just a thought.
Yeah, a bit of a wild thought, but you know, I'll give you that. Yeah, it's maybe, a thought. Maybe it's a big one. And I have it too.
Maybe years down the line.
Potentially. So, all right. Now to close. Today's show was produced by Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio. We're your hosts, Quinn Miles and Julian Schiff-Massad. If you like these interviews, you could find out more on the Queen's Pro Bono Radio website.